tonight on Arena. Richard Carney speaks to us about his novel Salvage, and we celebrate 50 years of cult horror with The Wicker Man. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. When the skills of novelist and philosopher mingle and merge, we can look forward to a deep dive into the resulting story. The writer in question here is the philosopher and intellectual Richard Carney, who is currently the Charles Selig Professor of Philosophy at Boston College. Salvage is Richard's third novel, and in the book he explores the never-ending tug of war between traditionalism and modernity through the life of a 14-year-old girl called Maeve O'Sullivan. She lives with her father on Ilan Vrije, steeped in the ancient ways of healing and in the old language. But her ties to the island are soon to be tested and her belief in the old ways challenged. Richard will be taking part in the West Cork Literary Festival on July the 7th. And suitably enough, he joins us now from our Cork studio. Good to have you with us this evening, Richard. Salvage begins on the island of Ilan Vrije. And you're very clear about calling it Ilan Vrije as opposed to Rabbit Island. Let's be clear on that one. But the setting of Ilan Vrije is almost a character in the novel itself, I would argue.
It is. And in that sense, it represents Maeve's relationship as an Irish speaker and as somebody who sort of draws from a native tradition of healing and what we might call, although she didn't call it, Celtic Christianity, a sense that, you know, the sacred is in nature. It's in the plants she uses with her father, who's a healer, the plants that grow on the island, the sea wracks, and her relationship to animals who she cures and humans who she cures. So whether it's human or non-human, she has this rapport with nature that still survived to some extent until the people of Ilan Vrije left the island in the 1950s. And I suppose the novel in some respects is trying to salvage some of the great riches of that particular tradition and bring them into the future. It's not just a nostalgic dive into a lost era. It's what can we retrieve with the collapse of, you know, the Catholic Church in these days from a native spiritual tradition that goes back to the old days, but, you know, the rule of Columbanus from the 9th to the 12th centuries before the division between Catholic and Protestant. There was a very rich spiritual tradition where nature itself was a sacred being. God was in all beings. And that's very important in our ecological crisis today.
And the fact that you have gone to Ilan Vrije, which of course is a direct reference to Saint Bridget, but we're talking about the Bridget, I suppose, never mind the saint bit, the Bridget of pre-Christian times.
We're talking about that Bridget, but who was carried over into early Christianity, and indeed down to this day. There's still many churches and schools in Ireland called after Saint Bridget. But we have tended to lose something of the original rapport of Bridget, the so-called pagan deity of fertility and of growth and creativity, with the Christian Saint Bridget. And of course, the two originally were one, because Patrick came not with the Roman army that imposed Christianity from Rome or elsewhere. He came as a slave and a hostage. And so there was a coming together, a synthesis of the original Celtic spirituality, which was very much what was called panentheistic. It believed that God was in all beings. And you find that in John Scotus Erugena and our £5 note. He believed that very much. And so Maeve draws from a tradition that is pagan and Christian, early Christian. And that is important. And I think it's something that can be retrieved. I mean, I was wonderfully surprised to see that St. Bridget has now been made into a national holiday in Ireland, I believe. And I think there is in the young generation a great interest in these native spiritual traditions and healing traditions, again, as a way of responding to our ecological crisis.
And is that very much the Bridget that you want to salvage in the telling of her story through Maeve, through this character of your Maeve? Is it that pantheistic aspect of her teachings and of her beliefs, and I suppose of that particular era. Is that what you're looking to salvage?
Very much so. As along with the names and the places and the stories and the memories that are being lost, and that some of the old people still speak. I mean, many of the names that I deploy in the novel were taught to me by a local recently passed neighbour called James Neal, wonderful man, and he told me the names of all these places that are basically, you know, being lost from memory, and including them in the book was a way of, in a way, guarding them for, again, as I insist, for the future. Even though there's nobody living on so-called Rabbit Island anymore, it was renamed Rabbit Island in the 19th century Ordnance Survey map. We know all about that from Brian Friel's translation. And the original name, Ilan Vrida, was replaced. The speakers were Irish speakers, like Cape Clear. It was one of the, you know, West Cork Irish-speaking islands. But with the loss of the language, there was the tendency to lose the very memories that were contained in the names. And to this day, some of the old people still call it Biddy's Island, Biddy being short for Bridget. And there was an ancient well there until the end of the 19th century, when it was banned by the church that because of people used to go on pilgrimages and it was considered too pagan. And then there was an accident at sea. So they banned that practice. But, you know, the wells of St. Bridget are still there in many places in Ireland, including the island of Ilan Vrida. But, you know, very few people go there anymore. And I think, you know, the sort of a resurgence of interest in that whole sort of nature spirituality now, and environmental spirituality and indigenous spirituality. That's not just in Ireland. You find it in indigenous cultures and spiritualities throughout the world now, Latin America, North America, Australia and Australasia. So I think it's a way for Ireland to reconnect with their own indigenous spirituality in a way that reconnects with other countries. You know, the local is the global in that sense.
Yes, and I mean, it struck me that parts of this novel, the novel is in English for the most part, but sections of it, quite definitely, you have some of the native speakers speaking to each other in Irish throughout the book. That is there. And the chapter headings, not the chapter headings, but the various plant life and sea life, you give us, in many cases, both an Irish version and the English translation of that Irish version of the name. I mean, you're not a native speaker, I'm guessing, Richard.
I'm not. I kind of wish I was.
Yeah, it's funny, you've kind of answered the question there, because I wondered, I got this a distinct sense from the book that, not nostalgia, but that you have a real sense of loss around us not using the Irish place names and around us not using the Irish plant names, and indeed the loss of the language.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's like Joni Mitchell's song, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. And I've lived in Boston for the last 23 years. And when you're away, you kind of really cherish the things you've lost. And I learned Irish at, you know, the Christian Brothers in Cork, CBC. And later with the Benedictines, there were some great Irish speakers there, Sean O'Din and others, Noreen Irene. But I'm not a native speaker, but I did, in writing the novel, and it's probably there's less than 1% of Irish actually in the novel. And when it's used, it's also sort of you get the paraphrase in terms of the context. But I found that in relearning the names, and in fact learning them in many respects, of plants and birds and sea wracks, and there are so many different names in Irish that you don't have in English, because there was a whole richness. Like there are, you know, 30 names for white snow in Inuit. There were so many names in Irish that when you rediscover them, that there are three ways of describing one kind of sea wrack in English as three names in Irish. And somebody like, I mean, I'm not the only one sort of, how shall I put it, appreciating this. People much more important than me as Irish speakers, like Manachon McGann, you know, and Michael Cronin in his book Irish and Ecology, have pointed out how the words are treasuries. They're treasuries. And if you open them up, they unlock these resonances and secrets. I mean, I'll just give you one example. The word suetude that appears in several times in the book, it's actually a word I learned from Manacon McGann when he was down looking at Bridget Ireland. We were making a little film, and I put it into the novel because he persuaded me, and I believed it, that if I learnt the name for the sound of the sea coming into a cove of pebbles, and then the swish as it turns and recoils, the sound that the sea makes in that particular specific moment is suetu. So it's suetu. It goes forward and then it pulls back.
Yeah.
And as I heard him say it, I realised that I was hearing the not only the word for the first time, I was hearing the sound of the sea for the first time. So it's in nature, it's there. It's not coming out of my head or out of a dictionary, but the sound releases the actual experience of the thing itself.
And even it struck me, I mean, I happen to have a couple of them open. Nyan Thog for nettle, it's a nicer sound, but I'm looking specifically at Shkiach Yal, which would translate literally as bright bush.
Exactly.
Which is much nicer than hawthorn.
It is.
In my book.
And bright bush also kind of contains the fact that there was a splendour and a radiance about the hawthorn because of its traditional healing powers and magical powers. So hawthorns very often grew near Bridget's Wells and were considered trees of healing and transformation. So the words contain the meanings that, again, are not lost indefinitely. You know, the salvaging is not, well, first of all, it's not just about what the islanders do with shipwrecks. It's set in the Second World War. So there's quite a lot of, you know, traffic going back and forth between North America and Great Britain. And the islanders, you know, lived in part off the salvage from these wreckages. But it's also salvaging these, you know, secret, hidden, latent names within the language. But I would insist again and again for the future. I mean, I don't want to give away the last scene, but Maeve is not moving into the past. She's moving into the future. And she's actually combining her native healing ways with her future as a medic, as a midwife, as a nurse. It's not an either or, you know.
And yeah, she's not throwing away science for sure.
No.
But there is an important aspect, I think, to the there's a Father Keogh, the local priest, who is quite definitely, you know, he's very strict down the line. He's pure Christianity, pure Catholicism, and that's it. There are no other options. Because, in fact, Maeve's father, who very much fosters that natural world and that process of healing and teaches Maeve many of the skills that she's picking up, would have been referred to by many of the locals as a trickster, which kind of shows us the sort of judgment that was thrown on that whole learning at the time.
That's right. And of course, he was also called a trickster because one of his healing plants is the fungi, which was called the trickster puka. I mean, if you look up, you know, the old Irish dictionaries, you see that there are 10 names for fungi or mushrooms in Irish: puka. And puka was a mushroom because it had transformative psychoactive powers, sometimes used against the sadness in wakes. And it came and went. It was there one moment, gone the next. But it was also the trickster, you know, that figures could come back and shapeshift. They could come back as seals or horses or, you know, the lost souls of the dead, as in Heaney's wonderful poem, Port na Buki, you know, could come back in a sound. They could come back in another person. And they were considered tricksters as well. So there was a double sense of trickster. One, you didn't quite know what you were getting because it could be shifting in its shape, right? So you could transform sadness into joy. And many of these plants did just that. One of the main reasons people went to Bridget's Well in the old days on Ilan Vrida, Bridget's Island, was against the sadness, because the Irish are well known for their melancholy in the depth of winter. And Bridget's Day being the 1st of February, Lough Eilge Bhrida, 1st of February, was a day when people went for renewal. And in that sense, these healing plants and vegetations were transformative. But again, that's also been lost. We lost with the forests, you know, when Ireland was 80% oak tree. And again, I'm not trying to go back there, although I'd love to see
more the deciduous trees.
Absolutely, absolutely. In West Cork now, there are headlands that are growing indigenous forests. And again, that's the way of the future. It's not just going back to the past, but we lost most of our forestry under Henry VIII, actually, with the Elizabethan Tudor conquest. They were knocked down for the navy. Mm. And with it went a lot of the lore, you know, the Anglo-Norman invasion, then the Elizabethan, then, you know, the famine, one after the other, and then the loss of the language, the loss of the forestry. A lot of that native healing tradition was lost, but not completely. I actually wrote a letter to Sean O'Riordan's son, asking about, you know, his knowledge or his father's knowledge in Cúile of the healing plants, because they've done a huge revival, as you know, Gaelin and music. Mihola Suluan, Nori Nirin, that whole generation of young people who learned from Sean O'Riordan. And he told me, he said, the people used to know these healing ways, but he said it's the old knowledge and it's on its way out. And there was a great sadness
within that.
But I don't think it's completely lost, because...
Well, I pretty much get from the novel that what you want to do is salvage some of it. But I'm interested as a final idea, Richard. Obviously, the majority of your writing is of a philosophical nature and of a very, you know, highly intellectual nature in terms of how you would express it.
Yeah.
In the case of writing a novel, you're in a different place. You're telling a story, yet from speaking to you for the last 15, 20 minutes,
right,
I can hear that it is, you know, philosophy is all over it. Was it a very different discipline to put away the several, you know, the polysyllabic words and get down to a more basic form of storytelling? Was that a big challenge?
Well, you know, in a way, it was working from a different part of my brain and my soul. When I'm doing philosophy, it's conscious, it's scripted, it's prepared, it's prescribed. I know where I'm going. I've got a contract and I follow a table of contents and a set of arguments. When I was writing this book, and in fact, my two early novels also, I was writing from, I mean, I suppose, to put it simply, the unconscious. I was kind of channeling things that I overheard. Half the phrases in the book are overheard from my local neighbours in West Cork. And it's a different discipline, you know, and it took 10 years of just listening and then recording and then transcribing and translating. And I just would let my imagination play and sort of go on sabbatical, go on holidays, which was very different from what I do when I'm writing philosophy. Very, very different. And I mean, we have used the word panentheism today in this interview, which is a philosophical word going back to John Scotus' origin and the early Irish philosophers, the early Celtic Irish philosophers, who spoke Latin, Greek, English and Irish, but Gaelic was their native language. In any case, there are no big words in the book. They're all words that could only be spoken by a 14, 15-year-old girl and the inhabitants of that island, which sadly now is abandoned.
Of course, you don't need big words to carry big ideas either, isn't that? That's probably true as well. And it is a 14-year-old girl, as you say, that carries a lot of the philosophy of the book for us. Richard, fascinating to have spoken with you this evening. Thanks so much for being with us.
A great pleasure. Thank you, Sean.
That's Richard Carney there speaking to us about his novel Salvage, which is published by Arrowsmith Press. Richard will be taking part in the West Cork Literary Festival, 3 p.m. on July the 7th. That's at the Merino or the Old Methodist Church in Bantry. Full information on westcorkmusic.ie. Green Chat, best known as the frontman of one of Ireland's most acclaimed bands of recent years, Fontaines DC. He's just released, however, his first solo single. It is called The Score.
When I make my move to you, you will know, see I am that way.
Go. Not the same guitar sound for sure, but it is that wonderful voice, the voice of Graeme Chatton there of Fontaines DC. That his first solo single, a song called The Score. Well, here we are in the middle of June, heading towards Midsummer's Day, aren't we? Festival season is now upon us. We are heading out on the road here on Arena. First stop, a suite of programmes from the Galway International Arts Festival. Festival runs from July the 17th through to the 30th this year. We will be broadcasting two shows from Galway in the first week of the festival. Festival. That's on July the 20th and 22nd. Then in the second week of the festival, we're back down in Galway again for a very special event. Thursday, July the 27th, we have an audience with Druid Theatre Company at the Town Hall Theatre. This is celebrating their new production of Druid O'Casey, and you are invited to come along. In Druid O'Casey, the three plays of Sean O'Casey's Dublin trilogy, that's The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of a Gunman and Juno and the Peacock, will be presented by Druid Theatre Company. So on Thursday the 27th at 3 p.m. in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, we will be joined by the creative team behind Druid O'Casey, including director Gary Hines and the cast of the three plays, which will include Catherine Walsh, Marty Ray, Rory Nolan, Hilda Faye and Zara Devlin. I'll be chatting to the cast and the creative team about the whole process of bringing Druid O'Casey to the stage, the importance of the work, and of course the contemporary resonances of the plays. Real opportunity then to whet your appetite if you're lucky enough to have tickets for the shows. Equally an opportunity to explore the themes and theatricality of these much loved works. Special Arena Druid O'Casey from the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, Thursday, July the 27th from 3 to 4 p.m. Full details on how to get your tickets and book on druid.ie. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Pipeworks Festival returns to Dublin tomorrow, June the 20th, and it runs through until June the 25th. The festival brings a diverse programme of music with the organ at its centre and mounts events in some of the magnificent cathedrals, churches and concert halls which house them. On Thursday, the Tallis Scholars, who are one of the leading exponents of Renaissance sacred music in the world, will perform in Christchurch Cathedral with a programme that reflects on the music of William Byrd in this, the 400th year since his death. Delighted to be joined on the line now by Artistic Director of the Tallis Scholars, Peter Phillips. It's a big year for anniversaries and celebrating, or I suppose remembering, William Byrd in the 400th year since his death. But is this the 50th year of the Tallis Scholars, Peter?
Yes, apparently. I've rather lost count, but it is in fact the 50th year. Yeah.
The 50th year and the 2,500th performance, I believe.
Yes, that's a nice coincidence, actually. That comes up in July, so very soon, in fact. So it's just a haphazard it's a truthful number.
Yes.
But it's going to be in Italy, as a matter of fact. So we're going to be there.
Yeah. When you formed the Tallis Scholars back in 1973, what was in your mind in forming this particular group of singers, Peter?
Well, it was really, we were very young and we wanted to have kind of erudite fun. It was fun, believe it or not. This rather serious music was our idea of how to enjoy ourselves. And we put on a concert. Very few people came to it. And then we just put on another one next term. I was at Oxford. And so it went on until it established itself, but it took a long time.
How difficult is the music that you're performing? If I talk about, or if you tell me a little bit and tell our listeners a little bit about what constitutes or what characterizes Renaissance sacred music.
Well, the difficulty is in the fact that there are lots of melodies going on at once. And normally in later music, you've got one melody with a bass supporting it, and everyone can hear what's going on. In this kind of music, you've got anything up to 8 melodies, related melodies, but they're operating, being sung independently. So you have to present it, I think, you have to present this kind of music very clearly so that the audience can hear all the detail that's in it. And it's a teeming detail. Wonderful music, I think.
Yeah, so we're talking about polyphony, several sounds, I suppose, all at the same time.
Yes.
Is how that word would translate.
Yeah, absolutely.
The fact that you're called the Tallis Scholars, that suggests to me that Thomas Tallis, the composer of this type of music, was very important to you.
Yes, he always has been. I mean, he's an important figure anyway. Byrd alongside him, as you say, we're celebrating him this year. But Tallis and Byrd were great friends, and it's very good to put them together. They're not the same at all, but they sort of sparked off each other. And Tallis, I wanted to use Tallis's name. Byrd's name had already been used, in fact, in 1973, and so I chose Tallis. It was a fairly natural choice.
Let's have a listen to a piece of Tallis's music, which maybe will give us a sense of the polyphony that you're talking about, these several melodies happening, not at exactly the same time, but almost overlapping, not almost, actually overlapping. Let's have a listen to Miserere Nostri, a little section from it. A section there from the Miserere Nostri of Thomas Tallis, one of the pieces that the Tallis Scholars will perform at the Pipeworks Festival this coming Thursday in Christchurch Cathedral in Dublin. A couple of things that really strike me as I listen to that, Peter, not least of which is, yes, there are several melodies going on, most of the time only sung by one or two voices. This puts phenomenal pressure on the singers of the Tallis Scholars. There's a lot expected from them.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's quite a vulnerable activity, and they just have to shape up. If you put lots of voices on it to make them feel safe, you don't get the same impact. It sort of dilutes across the voices. I like to have very few voices so they can hear each other, they can react to each other, and they can blend with each other to produce that beautiful surface sound, which I hope we get. And then under that is all the detail I'm talking about.
And I guess the fact that it was designed, it's sacred music, it was written as sacred music, it was designed to be performed in big cathedral-like spaces, which you will have on Thursday night in Christchurch Cathedral, that allows for a natural kind of resonance, added resonance.
Obviously, we like singing in resonant places and in wonderful big cathedrals. So actually, a lot of this music was written for private chapels, much smaller buildings than you suggest. So the detail would have been automatically clearer in those smaller places. When we're singing in a big cathedral like Christchurch, we're going to have to go a bit slower and just clean things up and hope the building doesn't obscure the detail. That can happen in very reverberant places.
Yeah, I suppose that is the challenge. I hadn't realised that, but it makes sense in terms of Renaissance sacred music that it would have been tiny private spaces almost in which it was actually performed at the time. Your singers, though, they are effectively, even though they're singing in a choral group here, they are effectively soloists, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And I mean, they're soloists anyway. In fact, I tend to book people who, you know, we sing Baroque arias quite happily as another part of their work. So I want that sort of confidence and presentation. The problem is to make sure that they blend with each other, they don't clash in sound. I'm trying to produce a beautiful surface to the sound, which presupposes that they're all joining in with the same project to make it sound good.
How different is Renaissance sacred music from Renaissance secular music?
That's a very good question, because I don't want to do the secular music. It's quite different. We sing in Latin almost all the time, which, of course, the secular music is not usually in. And that Latin element just distances things a little bit from that sort of immediate English language or French language, Italian language that comes and overwhelms you just like that with one voice to a part. We tend to sing with two voices to a part to get that blend that I'm talking about. But one voice to a part is much more difficult to get a blend just like that. The voices will be much more sort of etched separately.
I want to, I suppose, one of the great exponents of this type of music, yes, of course, Thomas Tallis, we've heard a little bit from him there. I know you're not performing Allegri's Miserere Mei Deus at the concert on Thursday evening, but it perhaps is one of the better known and most beloved of pieces from that period. Talk to me a little bit of what is asked of both the cantor here, because it varies between a cantor giving us, I suppose, a verse, and then the choral group giving us a chorus or a response to that. I don't know who's responding to whom, perhaps.
Well, it's quite hard work for everybody, actually. It's got to sound as easy as falling off a log, but actually the cantor indeed has to, he does half the work, in fact, because it's a psalm. So we're just singing straight through the psalm text, and Allegri set it full for choir, then chant, then full for a solo choir, and then chant. And so it goes on in a liturgical repetition, ritualistic, until you get to the end. But the chant singer has to bear quite a lot of the burden. And then, of course, the high solo soprano who hits a high C five times in the course of this piece. I would think that's a tremendous ask. I've never done it myself.
Well, we listen to a little section where we hear that high C and perhaps a little bit of the next verse then from the cantor.
Lovely.
section there from the Miserere Mei Deus of Gregorio Allegri, the composer, performed there by the Talis Scholars and featuring that high C that Peter Phillips, one of the founder members and current artistic director of the Talis Scholars, was mentioning about before we went into it. I noticed that one of the Talis singers, Caroline Trevor, recently performed her 1900th That's a lot of performances with with the group. Was Caroline perhaps the soprano that had to hit that high C, or does she have to hit that? She's an alto, is she?
Yeah, she's an alto and has always been an alto. And one of the tricks there is not a trick, but it's a fact of life that when you get older, your voice, the muscles relax in your throat and you find it harder to sustain high notes. So, and the lower notes become more accessible. And that's basically what's happened with, well, it happens with the basses and it happens with the altos. So she's been able to sing much longer than a high soprano, actually.
Now, that's interesting. That's part. So the alto has a kind of a longer voice life, if you like, than the soprano has. You mentioned the fact that I was asking you about how many voices to the part. And you said in the case of the Talis Scholars, you have it doubled up, which I suppose is there in the name of your record company, Gimmel.
yes, that's quite, it's not quite right, but I know what you mean. Gimmel is a twin. It's the Latin word gemellus that the word comes from, and it's twinned. But it's not that we twin the singers in the group exactly. It's that the composers at the time, in order to write one of those really spectacular sections that they particularly liked, they would twin the voice part. So where there was one voice part going into the section in question, there would suddenly be two, and you could have a double Gimmel and even a triple Gimmel, so the voice parts just expand exponentially. It's a fantastic effect.
Was William Byrd fond then of a bit of gimmeling within his compositions? Because we're going to finish up by listening to some of the Tribuet Domine.
Well, unfortunately, he was a bit late for the gimmel technique. That came with Talis and the earlier composers, Taverner and that lot. Byrd, I can't think of a gimmel by Byrd, actually, though he would often twin the soprano parts, which you can hear in Tribuet Domine coming up now. It's a six-part piece, so and the tenors are twinned in that way, not quite in the way I'm thinking, but anyway. There are two tenor parts and two soprano parts, as well as an alto and a bass.
We will finish up by listening to the Talis Scholars and their version, or one of their versions, one of their many recordings, I'm sure, of the music of William Byrd, the Tribuet Domine, and looking forward to hearing more of the music at the concert on Thursday evening. Safe travelling, Peter, and see you when you get
to
Dublin later in the week. That's Peter Phillips, our Artistic Director of the Talis Scholars, performing in Christchurch Cathedral this coming Thursday, June the 22nd, as part of the Pipeworks Festival. Find the full details of their event and indeed the festival on pipeworks.ie. And we'll finish with a section of William Byrd's Tribuet Domine. William Byrd's Tribuet Domine there, as sung by the Talis Scholars, who will perform this Thursday, 22nd, in Christchurch Cathedral as part of the Pipeworks Festival. Pipeworks.ie for full details. It's the chilling tale of naivety and self-delusion in the face of unspeakable manipulation and evil, and all set in a wilderness that is as beautiful as it is feral. The 1973 film The Wicker Man was a cult classic, the first so-called folk horror, which showed that quality storytelling and deftly crafted cinematic tension can create more profoundly disturbing effects than any amount of blood and gore. 50 years on, some people now even consider The Wicker Man to be the Citizen Kane of the genre. Film stars Edward Woodward as the well-intentioned police officer who uncovers pagan goings-on when he is sent to a remote Scottish island to search for a missing girl. The always macabre Christopher Lee plays the Laird of the Island, seemingly a god among men, who holds the population in the palm of his ritualistic hand. And as the summer solstice approaches, special screenings of The Wicker Man are scheduled for this Wednesday, June the 21st, around the country. With me in studio to dig into the film and its legacy is Siobhan Kane. And it is kind of creepy stuff, this, as well as everything else. Christopher Lee, without Christopher Lee, we might never have seen this, in fact, though, Siobhan.
It may never have come to pass, because this actually is based on David Pinner's book Ritual from 1967. And Michael Winner and John Hurt were originally attached. It began as a film treatment, but then it stalled. And then David Pinner said, OK, I actually think a novel is in the works for this. Christopher Lee got wind of this. And in 1971, he wanted to reshape his career because he was so linked to Hammer Horror that he thought he needed something that was atmospheric, a little bit discordant, and even eerier in a different way to the Hammer. Because Hammer Horror have their own atmosphere as well, but he thought it was a bit schlocky and he wanted to reshape. So he bought the film rights from David Pinner.
Yeah, it's a very kind of, I mean, when you think of the Hammer Horror, there's always going to be blood and there's always going to be, you know, a woman, a heaving bosom somewhere who's in trouble.
Sacrificing or being sacrificed.
Yeah, but it's you know, it's a kind of a, it's a whole different, it's a different place than The Wicker Man, for sure. In fact, we were just saying as you came in, The Wicker Man, it's a different kind of world from the Richard Carney novel The Salvage, in that it's a much darker place, but it is about that interaction between kind of Christianity and a more naturalistic, pantheistic, to use the word for the fifth time tonight.
Yes,
world.
It's very true, because even a big touchstone for The Wicker Man was The Golden Bough, which some listeners might know, the James Frazer book, which was about religion and mythology and the kind of interplay between both and the differences. And it kind of, it's riffing on outsider, insider, paganism, Christianity, the old world, the new world, enlightenment, anti-enlightenment, and again about the rural and the urban as well, with, you know, Neil Howie, played by Woodward, coming in from as the
mainland. He's the policeman. Why is he coming to the island? What's he investigating, this missing girl? How much do you need to tell
us? Well, just for anybody that hasn't watched it, and please do if you can, it's, but with somebody with you, it's very frightening, is he gets a mysterious letter, an anonymous letter that says this island in the Hebrides, there is a young girl who's missing, and he gets a tip off. So then he's sent, and he, the kind of the early part of The Wicker Man is him in his little plane going in, you know, and the kind of the Robbie Burns song, The Corn Rigs, that Paul Giovanni kind of reshapes, Robbie Burns, along with a lot of interesting folk songs, are reshaped in The Wicker Man. And it's this incredible, iconic kind of, where he's the kind of outsider, you know, the kind of, he represents the law, he represents order, he represents a certain society that he's coming from, into a very close society, but he doesn't know what is about to happen. He cannot predict.
No, nobody could predict what was about to happen. Well, you probably could predict it, but he certainly couldn't. Paul Giovanni, you're mentioning there, as the who wrote the film score, and as you say, it to a large extent took folk music and took well-known tunes and kind of played around with them. In fact, we're going to hear that bit of it. Very disturbing first clip, which gives us a sense of the world that we're heading into. This is where a stranger walks into a bar. Edward Woodward is the aforementioned stranger as Sergeant Howie. He's walking, going into Summer Isle, encounters a somewhat, to say they're sinister is a kind of an understatement, isn't it? Lindsay Kemp and Alder McGregor here, and Brick Eklund as the landlord start. Britt Eklund as the landlord's daughter.
Yes.
Britt Eklund as the landlord's daughter. Yeah, for the third time. Britt Eklund as the landlord's daughter. Willow. And this clip gives us a sense of what Giovanni was doing with the music.
Are you the landlord here?
Aye, I'm Alder McGregor. And you must be the policeman from the mainland.
Aye, that's right. Sergeant Howie, West Highland Constabulary. Now, I'm quite obviously not going to get back to the mainland tonight. So I wondered if he had a room and a bite of supper I could have. I mean, could you manage that?
Aye, I think that can be arranged. My daughter Willow will show you to your room. Willow?
Father?
This is Sergeant Howie, a policeman from the mainland who will be spending the night with us. This is my daughter Willow.
Good evening.
Show the sergeant to his room, will you?
Much has been said of the strumpets of yore, of wenches and baldy house queens by the score, but I sing of the baggage that we all adore. The landlord's daughter, you'll never love another. Although she's not the kind of girl to take home to your mother.
Hey,
is lively and...
I get the fine line of that little clip. That's from The Wicker Man, celebrating 50 years of The Wicker Man, which Fionn Caine this evening. It really is disturbing, and it gives you a sense of the kind of this place of sex and sexual ritual in this particular island. It's very frightening.
It's the idea as well. You think of Woodstock was 69, and then you got this kind of, it's coming out at 73 at a time when counterculture is kind of rejecting a lot of received social wisdoms and social order and anti-imperialism. So it's linking with that, but then it also brings it back, which is without the idea of free love, but how free, you know, is there a cost attached as well? Because at the root of The Wicker Man is the theme of sacrifice, but you're saying how much is one sacrificing? Also, who might be getting sacrificed? And even that clip that you played there, Sean, where they're in the pub, it's kind of almost this gladiator kind of, the pub becomes the kind of menacing, you know, usually it's a place of, you know, social glue and people are having drinks, kind of relaxed, and it's not as welcome, even from the clip, it's not so welcoming. It's almost sneering and jeering and strange. It's kind of the outsider comes in and they all are in on a joke, but he doesn't know the punchline yet.
But you also had an interesting little note that you were telling me about Lindsay Kemp, who is he's the landlord in the midst of all of that,
he is was the choreographer, a very famed choreographer who worked very closely with Kate Bush on a good few music videos, including Running Up That Hill, which of course is iconic in its own way. So he kind of pops up, all these weird things pop up in The Wicker Man, where you're kind of saying, okay, this just seemed, I mean, for a lot of the film, the actors thought it was going to be a musical, because the way that...
Well, there's a touch of Oom Papa, that gone very sinister, isn't there?
Very, from Oliver, exactly. The Lionel Bart thing is kind of interesting, because that he kind of links in my mind with this, and it's kind of a wonky, even further, kind of seedier Lionel Bart kind of soundtrack. But there is always a duality happening in The Wicker Man. And again, it's a place of moral ambivalence. And we're complicit as audience members. What do we think about Neil Howie? But also, what do we think of Lord Summer Isle? Are you on either side, or sometimes you drawn by the idea of the free-spiritedness and the mystery and the idea of going back to old cultures and old ways, or are you frightened by them? So
yeah, because that it's very much is about that old world, new world thing. That is part of it for sure. However, the Christopher Lee aspect of things, he brings this. I mean, he's always sinister in everything he does, and in the Hammer Horrors, is kind of the sinister is kind of high camp in some ways.
Yes,
this is a very different type of Christopher Lee that we get.
Very, it's majestic, because it's also riffing on class. He's Lord Summer Isle. He's the grandson of a Victorian agronomist. He's brought these particular plants to this island that was pretty barren before that. He's given them a bounty. He's godlike, as you mentioned at the beginning, and it's also about class, which is interesting, because by the end they're substituting one lord for another. They've rejected Christianity to Sergeant Howie's horror, and they've embraced Celtic paganism, but it's an idea about how people are shoring up power. You know, they kind of separate, we're not being subjugated, but are they or aren't they by Lord Summer Isle?
Subjugation is by somebody else, perhaps.
Exactly.
Let's have a listen to a scene between Howie, then the Edward Woodward character, and Lord Summer Isle, played by Christopher Lee, at his uncanny best here.
I trust the sight of the young people refreshes you.
No, sir. It does not refresh me.
Oh, I'm sorry. One should always be open to the regenerative influences. I understand you're looking for a missing girl.
I found her.
Splendid.
In her grave. Your lordship is a justice of the peace. I need your permission to exhume her body, have it transported to the mainland for a pathologist's report.
You suspect foul play?
I suspect murder and conspiracy to murder.
In that case, you must go ahead.
Your lordship seems strangely unconcerned.
I'm confident your suspicions are wrong, Sergeant. We don't commit murder up here. We're a deeply religious people.
Religious? With ruined churches. No ministers, no priests. And children dancing naked.
Do love their divinity lessons.
But they are naked.
Naturally, it's much too dangerous to jump through the fire with your clothes on.
Well, well explained. Thank you, Christopher Lee, as Lord Summerisle there in The Wicker Man. Of course, Edward Woodward as Sergeant Hoey. Siobhan Keane celebrating 50 years of The Wicker Man. Even that, the little bit on the piano is sinister in the way he does it. How has that, this film, because it is, some people say, the Citizen Kane of cult horror. Yes. How has it, what has it influenced in more recent times?
I would say there's a direct line from, a lot of listeners will have seen Hereditary and Midsommar by Ari Aster. Midsommar is the most obvious.
Midsommar particularly, yeah.
Very much, because it's about this idea of these American students, and they're all kind of, it's almost kind of riffing on, oh, the Coachella, it's going to be so charming and wonderful. And then it's about trauma, I suppose, Midsommar as well. Yeah. And then it's about how the mob will sacrifice the individual and you can be swept along, which I think is a topic that is ever apposite. So there's that, but there's also other less obvious things like Bait by Mark Jenkins or A Field in England, and it's about a thing that links into hauntology and temporal dislocation, and it's a very particular British kind of eeriness that Ari Aster, who is not British, kind of links into. It's something very unsettling but also very compelling.
All right. Will you watch it on the 21st? Is Midsommar the perfect time to watch it?
It actually is, although I'm very superstitious and I'm a big scaredy cat, so I would be too afraid. I love The Wicker Man, and I would be too afraid that something would happen.
So you're going to wait until the 22nd, are you?
I think that's safe.
All right. So either follow Siobhan Keane's advice and wait until the 22nd, or you can see The Wicker Man several screenings this Wednesday, June the 21st, the summer solstice, cinemas around the country. Check your local listings for details. Thanks to Siobhan Keane for that. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.